Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
We are running a panel focused on corporate VCs. There's a lot of question marks on what that actually means, how that relates to other venture capital groups, what the day-to-day is sort of like within this versus other corporate VCs, and then also obviously digging into what's going on right now. And in order to help us get deeper into all of that, I'm excited that we have Allison Goldberg and Ryan Piello with us. They can both give an introduction onto their background and what they do. And that would be great.
Sure. I'm happy to go first. I'm Allison Goldberg. I run the Ventures Group at Comcast. I've been here close to 2 years and joined after a long career in corporate venture at Time Warner. I was there for about 18 years. So I've been doing corporate VC for a while now. It's a great way to invest. So I'm happy to give more info about Comcast Ventures. Should I do it now? Or
I would love to learn more.
So at Comcast Ventures, we're investing in companies that are innovating in spaces that are consistent with areas that we're interested in from a growth perspective. So categories, maybe not right on top of the core business right now, but sectors that we're really interested in as a company to learn more about, technologies that we're interested in learning more about, and maybe some business models that we're interested in learning about. So every year we revisit what our focus areas are and should be. Right now it's things like future of work, digital health, energy and sustainability, prop tech. And then we have a catch-all bucket for enabling technologies where things like AI, quantum, and cybersecurity would fit there. So those are the kinds of sectors that we're looking at from a stage standpoint, typically Series A. We've gone earlier. We could certainly go later. We invest anywhere from like about $1 million on the low end up to about $7.5 million when we first go into a company. And we're comfortable in their leading deals or co-leading. We want to be an active investor in the company. So we don't want to just write a bunch of checks and then sort of see what happens. We really want to be actively involved. So we're typically either on the board or an observer on the board of the companies that we make investments in.
Amazing. And it's, you know, with what the world knows about Comcast, the products that we sort of experience on a daily basis, internet, TV, all that. It's interesting that you mentioned things like prop tech and that being somewhat strategic in the future of work. And that being somewhat strategic to Comcast, how does that sort of fall into it?
Yeah, well, so at Comcast, we have a huge business selling to businesses called Comcast Business. So the future of work scene sort of falls into that business line that we have already and looking for other interesting ways to serve our customers. And then prop tech, and just think about the fact that we're in all of these homes across the U.S., with our broadband service and other services, thinking through what are some other interesting angles from just getting to more consumers really standpoint.
That makes a lot of sense. Having a fuller 360 within someone's home, like, so that could be how prop tech kind of works with it.
How we could sort of sell our services in through third parties building, maybe we've invested in companies building like greener apartment building complexes and things like that.
Very cool. Thanks for that rundown. And then Ryan, we'd love to hear more about kind of your journey and what you're up to.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here and to share. So I'm Ryan Pila, Executive Director at the Estee Lauder Companies, and I work on our new incubation ventures team. So that is our early stage corporate venture capital arm. So for those who maybe don't know, the Estee Lauder Companies, it is a New York based beauty conglomerate. So we have over 30 beauty brands that are underneath our umbrella. In the Estee Lauder brand being one, but many that other people are probably familiar with, La Mer, The Ordinary, Le Labo. And so some of these businesses, Estee Lauder Companies has acquired, some we've built. And so what our group has done was launched about 2 years ago to say, how can we partner with or play at the early stages of these beauty brands? So we look kind of globally anywhere from pre-launch to businesses doing up to 20 million in revenue all at that early stage, strategically focused to Estee Lauder Companies. So hair care, body care, skin care, makeup, fragrance, saying who is doing something new and exciting, similar to Allison, playing in areas core to us, but on the edge cases, what's net new? Where's the consumer moving? What are new geographies? What's new innovation? And finding ways to sort of discover partner with those founders, create new brands with soon to be founders, and generally supporting the ecosystem, all within sort of prestige and luxe beauty.
That's awesome. And fun fact, one of my first jobs was actually writing copy for a bunch of Estee Lauder brands. And I just basically used illuminating for every single thing. For illuminating hair, use this. For illuminating skin, use this. I don't know fully even what illuminating totally means. However, it felt like it worked. I got away with it. That's all I remember.
Your skin looks good.
Thank you. And so you all invest fairly early in a lot of these brands, like before they've even really started making legitimate money, right?
Yeah, we'll definitely go pretty early. So at that pre-launch, pre-revenue stage, we're investing in sort of founders and ideas and themes. But the bigger stages of where our realm is similar to what Estee Lauder companies has done in the past. So Deciem, that owns The Ordinary, or Dr. Jart, we invested in them when they were kind of younger and technically places that would fall within our realm, and but built in a long-term partnership. So built in areas to support them and potential realms to acquire more in the future. So we'll kind of bridge the gap. Let's say, hey, maybe you're established and there's a chance to scale. Maybe it's an idea. We want to kind of grow it and create it together and everything in between.
It's amazing. And there's so many beauty products out on the market, right? In so many categories in terms of serums, sprays, shampoos, washes. Oftentimes, now this is from my ignorant point of view, the ones that get a lot of traction in terms of funding and whatnot, they already kind of have built a brand either through a celebrity or a lot of influencers or whatnot, but you're taking these brands and putting money and effort and resources into them before they've really even gotten there. So like, how do you pick and choose someone? Because again, it's so crowded and the products are maybe developed and good, but they're not even developed to the level that they will be in a few years.
Yeah. And since we started this group 2 years ago, I think we've seen close to 2,500 beauty brands that we've evaluated. And across the globe too. And so, and we're always bringing in a handful of different data points, like the difference for a corporate venture capital is, and especially for ours, is the strategic alignment, right? We're not looking for a La Mer 2.0. We're saying, okay, who's a customer we don't serve, or a skincare or hair care need we can't address, or a geography that we know maybe has something that a locally built brand could address or tap into better. And so for us, it's what are the strategic goals, like Allison was saying, kind of where are those white spaces or those edge cases that we want to play. And then a little bit for us as well is, where's the market going? I mean, consumers are becoming more educated, they're changing, they're evolving. Depending on the geography, they're sort of at different levels of the journey. And so layering on what people need and what they're asking for, along with sort of our corporate strategy, and then adding in what the startup's doing of saying what's new. And we do see a lot of There is duplication, right? The barriers to entry to creating a beauty brand are really low. We see a lot of people that are maybe creating in a space that others already own or others already exist in, whether it's our brands or other brands in the market. And so at that stage, we do a lot of understanding, all right, is it a new distribution model, a new category or a subcategory? Is there new innovation from the R&D standpoint? Is it a new customer? Just, it is a lot. And I think the benefit of us being focused on beauty is, we're comparing everything against itself, and it becomes hopefully a bit easier to pair out. Oh, what is seeing a founder saying, this is something new, because we talked to 50 other companies this week, and this is the first one that stood out to us. So it almost helps when you know the space so well to be able to identify some of the buttoniness.
Yeah. And since you're so deep in that space, are you already kind of, and you've talked to so many different companies that are looking for funding and probably who are established and whatnot, you're doing a lot of your own research. Do you feel like you already know where the holes are of, this is an area that doesn't really have too much competition, so it'd be great to see a pitch in this area? Or is it really the founders who really are educating you, and it's really up to them to come up and wow you and show you those areas, instead of you kind of saying, okay, I'd love to do something here because I'm just not seeing a lot of the competition there?
It's both. I wish I knew everything. If I did, we'd all be billionaires by now. No, we're learning every day, but we also do come in with our theses. It's interesting. We have a couple deals that we're sort of in the process of closing. And when we do, we'll be at a portfolio of 9, right? Which is pretty small. Do you think a third of that portfolio, so 3 out of the 9, are ones that we invested in pre-launch, pre-revenue. And when that happens, that may be an instance of us saying, all right, we have a thesis on something that we think there's an opportunity for disruption. right? Whether it's new or whether there's an incumbent that we've, you know, hasn't innovated in a while or an opportunity. And when we're kind of investing pre-launch, we're meeting founders who are saying, hey, I also have seen this and I'm passionate about it. And so we join at that early stage when those theses match, right? And, but there are definitely spaces that we see kind of that are emerging or changing where we say, hey, we'd love to see something in this realm. Like, I'll give an example. SPF right now is going through a lot of changes, right? It's been sort of the established drugstore brands. And it's like, well, can you make something? I think Supergoop did a great job of making a daily wear, right? And you have consumers that's becoming more educated about the detriments of sun, getting more comfortable with daily wear. And so it's, where does SPF come into play? That maybe where we play prestige and luxury, right? Elevates it out of the drugstore, builds it into products in a unique way, whether it's for cool delivery models like mists or whether it's in your makeup or skincare. And like, how do you just go about it in a different way and kind of like tap into that consumer need?
That's a great example. And yeah, me and Ryan were both at a dinner and one of the other venture investors there basically was, who also does work in beauty, was pulling up pictures of how people's skin deteriorates when they're not actually using any sun protection, because I mentioned I don't almost ever. And he's like, you've got to start now. I'm like, okay. And this is great education and everyone's talking about it. No one talked about it, I would say, at least amongst men, is so regularly, when everyone could use these products. So it's going, like you're saying, it's going through a breakthrough.
Have you started using it? I'm telling you, yeah, sunscreen, daily wear, one of the best things you can do for your skin.
The answer is no, but I'm at least more educated. So it's a multi-stage process. Cool. Well, since you both are so experienced within the corporate venture space, I'm just curious, what are the differences between being a corporate VC versus other VCs that are not backed by a corporate? Would love to learn some basics there of how it differs.
Yeah. I mean, all corporate,
and also possibly where it is similar.
Yeah. I mean, what I like to say when we talk to entrepreneurs and other people about some, what it means to take money from a corporate VC, the way I've always thought about it is we want to be just like a financial investor in terms of our documents and term sheets and all the rights we're asking for are going to be the same as a traditional VC. We're not asking for any extra sort of bells and whistles or things in that regard. So the money and the documents and the governance is all the same. We're going to do the same amount of work if we're on the board in terms of all the things the great VCs do as board members in terms of helping on committees, helping with raising new rounds, helping with M&A, helping with comp, all this and stuff. And then on top of that, we want to provide something additionally, which is sort of access to our company, helping get companies meetings with whomever they want to meet with around our company, help them with business to the extent we can internally and externally also, because we're sort of so sector and thematic based, we can sort of help in a different way. But we like to say we want to do everything that a traditional VC does plus and bring a little bit more to the table to the extent we can, the portfolio company. So we can't, at least in our case, we can't promise operating deals are definitely going to come, but we can definitely help put the right people in front of the decision makers and help get feedback on how those meetings went and help sort of the process along from an operating deal standpoint. We can't promise that it's going to happen. But
of course.
Yeah.
And when you say an operating deal, does that mean being able to sign some kind of paid contract with Comcast itself or with one of Comcast's partners and being able to?
Yeah, any of that. We have people on our team who are helping internally. So not only the partners on the deals, but also like a platform associate and the staff person who helps sort of shepherd the companies within Comcast. But so it's great if we can end up with an operating deal, like a paid contract, but sometimes we don't, and that's okay too.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Any thoughts, Ryan?
Yeah, I always, especially for like founders or people who aren't as tapped into corporate venture, I always like to say there's a spectrum, because you can have corporate venture arms that are very financially focused, have their own fund and are very financially like returned, similar to a typical VC. I think on the other end of the spectrum, you get strategic corporate venture capital arms. And we're very strategic in what we do. And while, to Allison's point, still very financially minded, whether it's the metrics you look at startup side or keeping tabs on our returns, still playing like a VC, but almost our KPIs change. And because of that, and especially in our case, our time horizon changes. If you have a more typical venture capital fund that has a 10-year life and a 5-year deployment period, they're looking to go raise their next fund, maybe 4 years into the fund, so that they can have another one already ready to go by the time they've deployed capital, which means they have a 3 to 4 year time horizon, right? In the short term. Some of what we're focused on is saying, can we find the next brand that wants to join the Estee Lauder companies, right? Become that 31st, 32nd, 33rd brand. And we're a 76-year-old business. And so while we are driving and keeping paying attention to revenue, as an example, we hyper push for revenue in the short term at the detriment of the brand and the authority that it can create in the long term that doesn't serve us. And so we may have a 5, 7, 10-year time horizon. And so because of kind of that change in our goals, wanting to bring businesses in and our goals on how we think about brand building and growth, it may just shift from what a VC is looking for. So some of the changes that I think we notice on our end.
That's really fascinating. And given that you're allowing these startups to grow, that's an amazing pitch that like, yeah, hey, you don't have to be exit ready within this time horizon or like pump or juice your numbers up as quickly as possible. Like, you just got to build a great company and understand revenue is part of that, but it's a part of it. And yeah, to be in. And so is kind of like dangling the opportunity that one day Estee Lauder may acquire you. Is that like a big pull for working with a corporate VC? And I'd imagine different corporate VCs use that carrot a little bit more than others based on whether it is actually the truth, whether a lot of these investments are coming in with the idea of the corporate parent acquiring them. We see P&G and Nestle acquiring a bunch of the companies that they put rounds into. And I'm guessing that's part of the appeal, but yeah, curious there.
Yeah. And I'd say we're very bespoke in what we do. And so I think all 9 of our deals in a very different structure. Some of them have that more implicitly built in or as actually part of the term sheet. How can we build a long-term relationship? Because the brand's ready for it and the founder's ready for it. Some function very similar to what Allison was saying, right? Can we match with what's on the market from other terms of capital and build deals the same way and structures and support founders from that perspective? I do think, and I like the idea of saying it's money plus or investment plus, because I think there is that long-term potential that's there and saying, hey, we're working together, right? We know you better. We can help coach and strategically guide in a way that does make it a lot more attractive for an acquisition. But also in the meantime, it's all the space in between where it's tapping our 60,000 people company to grab those experts and talk to them and learn. I'm not a product development expert or an IP or tax expert or I don't have connections at all the retailers, but we have teams that do, right? So I think it's a little bit of that extra support and then knowing in the long run, it may demystify and de-risk the exit opportunity.
That makes sense. Is it kind of similar with you, Allison, as well, that it's always sort of a possibility there, but you don't want to necessarily promise anything that everyone you're investing in is eventually going to be looked at as a Comcast acquisition?
Yeah, we don't think about it that way. No. And that could be hard for the companies, right? Tech companies tend to not like that lot so much from a startup perspective. So it's simply not part of sort of how we do it. We also have a lot of investments and we're not buying millions of companies. So it's just not part of the model, and we're happy to sell the companies as an investor if we do the highest bidder at the end of the day. So
makes sense.
It would be great. You know, it'd be a good scenario if that were to end up happening for sure. And we'd all be really happy and excited about it, but it's definitely not in the model it's looking at. The company.
I'm curious, Allison, I have a question on that. Some of before our group was started, led by a woman named Shauna, who previously ran our M&A team. And so she moved over and having proven it out with Decium and Dr. Jart, knowing that minority investments can turn into that, she launched this and I joined. But the thesis before starting was we were uncertain on whether founders would want that.
Yeah.
And I think some of where my thesis, and I'd love to get your take on it, is like within beauty, I think you don't have a lot of acquirers, right?
Yeah, I think it's a different mark, especially if we're back to the reality of these are D2C brand kind of companies versus tech companies, right? And so you're right, they don't have a lot of potential acquirers. They also probably, there aren't as many venture funds who are going after those kinds of businesses right now. And there aren't a lot of IPOs kind of those businesses. Yeah. So I just think it's a different mentality for those companies. And they're probably... It makes total sense. They'd want to sell to Estee Lauder, and that's probably a real carrot for them. Whereas some of the more tech companies are not necessarily even thinking M&A. They want to go public and be $10 billion companies kind of thing. So it's a mindset difference.
Yeah, hundreds and thousands of potential acquirers too, right? So probably limiting those options with too closely tying to an exit opportunity with you makes it a little bit less attractive for a tech. Interesting nuance.
Yeah. And just goes to show every corporate VC group is not going to operate the same way and have the exact same pitch. And even the audience that you're pitching, beauty founders are very specific versus, let's say, AI founders, whatnot, in their eventual goals. So that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, we're reading the news and we're all part of like an ecosystem that is seeing some level of doom and gloom over the past 6 to 12 months. And supposedly, we'll continue over the next 6 to 12 months. With that, what are you sort of seeing out there in terms of how your day-to-days have shifted? Either, number one, are you sort of pulling back some of the investments that you're thinking about making and slowing down a little bit? And also, are the types of companies that you would consider putting money into shifting in some way? Obviously, there's always shifts in what's popular. Like you mentioned earlier, like SPF is something that could be looked at differently now than it was before. And also you're getting new industries like AI and whatnot that are getting very popular with funding from a lot of investment vehicles. But beyond just how industry shift, just moreover, are there fundamentals you're looking at differently in startups that you would consider versus not consider? Whereas maybe 3 years, it looked a little bit different. Would love to learn how that's shifted. You're choosing to invest in and also choosing not to pursue investing in.
And we're not slowing down in terms of wanting to make more investments and putting money to work, I think. And for us also, because we're more thesis driven from a sector focus, we're going to continue looking at those sectors and hopefully finding great opportunities. I think the day-to-day definitely shifted towards more portfolio work of late, just given companies needing some more runway, companies needing help with cost containment and things like that to prolong their runway. So I'd say day to day, there's definitely over the past 6 to 12 months, a lot more work just with portfolio companies, but we're still super excited and active to put new money to work into the sectors that I mentioned before. And I think maybe what's changed is timing, like our time frame of diligence. I think we're just back to the pre sort of 2020, 2021 times where you had more time to do diligence, more time to spend with the company, with the teams. It's not just one or two Zooms and you have to make an investment decision. I think investors now have more time to spend really getting to know the companies and the teams before they make their investment decisions. I think that's great. So I'm excited about that. But yeah, we're still active. I think obviously valuations are down and I think that makes sense. I think we're just being a little bit more rational from a multiple standpoint and wanting to make sure that whatever money is coming in now will last the company's 18 to 24 months. So we're really focused on that piece as well.
That's great. FOMO is fun for everyone outside of the venture world. I think a lot of agencies like my own and others benefited from there being so many well-funded companies out there, but it's not fun seeing a lot of the companies you used to work with suddenly now going through hardships. And even from our side, the companies that are actually growing and hiring and coming back to us, it's frankly those ones who turned down some of that FOMO money a couple of years ago and have valuations that were a little bit more logical. And they're still hiring executives, they're still growing, and they're catching up to those companies that are now doing a little bit of the opposite. So it all plays out. It all plays out eventually. How about yourself, Ryan? Has anything changed in the last year or two in terms of how you kind of are approaching the quantity of companies you would potentially invest in and or what you're looking for inside of a company that would make it more investable for you?
Yeah, I think we're pretty similar to Allison and the way where we were so strategically focused and our goals to do 5 to 7 deals a year. So it's not an astronomical number. And I think this shift back from really high round, super quick timelines of where it was before, I think it has normalized. And that's been beneficial for us because we're a very meticulous and rational investor. And so when evaluations were high, there were rounds we couldn't participate in because we're like, we can't justify that valuation. Like, we don't see it. And we've been doing this for a while. And so I think bringing down valuations is something that's more reasonable. And then from a diligence perspective or a company review, the timelines in the market are closer to what we need anyway. I don't think we'll ever be able to cut a check in 2 days, like what some VCs are doing, right? And so I think as founders' expectations change to more realistic valuations, more realistic timelines, it makes our job a bit easier. I think the other, maybe more macro and interesting thing is when you have these times of uncertainty from people's jobs or their safety net, I think they start to, we see founders sort of, or I guess employees or soon to be founders questioning what they want to be doing. And we see me coming out of this of somebody saying, well, if I'm not so stable in my job, maybe now it's time to pull the trigger and go start that company I've always been thinking of. So I do think there's that portfolio support and helping the ones that we have invested in. We've seen more companies come back for additional phases. But what I'm really excited for is maybe coming out of this turmoil gives people that freedom to say, hey, maybe now's the time that I'm not so set in my job, right? Or my life shifted and changed. Let me go start that beauty company or that tech company. So that's what I'm really excited about, to see sort of what innovation comes out of it.
I agree. You can also, I mean, you look back in time, lots of great companies were started when the venture markets were amazing, right? So I think one of the advantages as a strategic is we're just continuing to be in the market and we're not, we don't have the external pressures of sort of LP issues and things like that, maybe pulling back from a capital standpoint.
And it's great to hear both of you aren't saying, well, we're just going to sit on our hands and wait and see for the next 6 to 12 months. What happens? You're actively out there. It's a lot of the content out there makes it feel like it's 100% doom and gloom. And like, there's no chance in being successful in certain areas. So it's wonderful to get some optimism in what both of you are doing in your day to day, and that it is a great time to build a company. Are there any examples of sort of like investments you either looked at or made recently where you're like, oh yeah, this is kind of why I was stoked about this and moved forward with this particular organization?
Well, we recently invested in a company called Hume.ai, and a really fascinating company based in New York. And they're sort of tackling this whole sort of problem of, can you, if we're using more AI in life on a go-forward basis, potentially, how do we understand sort of how people, actual humans, are feeling, right, in some of those conversations? And how do you sort of react to people based on sort of how they're feeling and their emotional state? And so it's a really fascinating company. They're building their own models to try to take people's, actual people's like voice and text and video content, and trying to determine sort of how they're feeling over the course of conversation, for example, or if they're interacting with the product or service or watching something. So it's an interesting company.
That's super interesting. And so given that's, it's a pretty futuristic product right there, something that will take time to prove out. What about that investment made you feel comfortable to make it?
Yeah, the team is fantastic. The CEO came out of Google and has a great history and background in the space. And also they have this very strong feeling about sort of AI for good, right? And thinking about it from a human emotional standpoint. And so we just really liked him, the team that he's assembled, and sort of how they're viewing the space and looking at the space. Also, they have a huge waiting list and lots of potential customers and people who are sort of ready to use the technology, ready to use the API. So that was really promising, and just a huge range of potential use cases we thought was really interesting as well.
That's amazing. So great team, thirstiness from a potential group of users who want this product that they were able to show, and technology that you were excited about. Sounds like a good combination of an investment. Cool. How about yourself, Ryan?
Yeah, I can talk to most of our portfolios, not public, but I can share one of the ones that we are excited about. It's a UK brand called Heckles. And what they do is what they call ocean powered beauty. So they're primarily a skincare business with candles and fragrance as part of it, but they started harvesting seaweed and kelp off the coast of the UK, where they're located just outside of London, and sort of just distill the seaweed and the algae and the kelp and the ocean ingredients down within their own manufacturing facilities to integrate into their products. And it's done in highly effective products. It's done in a way to really do what we try to do and bring beauty from the inside to the outside. But what was also interesting was a lot of what they're doing on the materials innovation side and sort of pushing the boundary. I think now we hear so much of people talking about clean and talking about what that means from a health perspective and or an environmental perspective. And they've done things like they were the first to market with a partner of theirs for fully compostable packaging. So drop it in the ocean and it's gone in 12 months, right? Not even industrial compostable, right? Just actually like home compostable. They're also working now to lab create ingredients that are more sustainable than their natural counterparts. If you think of the clearing of land and the water and the shipping and the all of that has to go in to create an ingredient that, though maybe natural, has a detrimental impact to the environment. So they're like, can we create something that's just as effective, if not more effective, in a more sustainable way that's still good for you? And they're doing some other work in terms of plastic alternatives and stuff, kind of all built out of their research and work within seaweed. So I've just been doing really interesting, kind of, I'd say, industry leading when it comes to clean and when it comes to the environment and it comes to sustainability, but all done in just like a very high quality product, great team, real luxury and prestige type of way. So matches well with us. And I think is kind of breaking some of the molds within beauty.
That's amazing. And it's giving the consumers what they've wanted over the last 5 years, right? Highly sustainable products. People are very open with saying they want better sustainability practices from what they're consuming. And so clearly this company has proven out or is on the process of proving out their vision for that. But it sounds like that vision towards how they're approaching sustainable products, or I'm sorry, sustainable ingredients and every single angle down to the packaging. Was that kind of the thing that was sort of a big draw? And then of course the team, but was that kind of the big draw for you to be like, okay, well, it doesn't produce revenue yet, but we really like what they're saying here.
Yeah. And they'd actually been around for a bit before we had invested in them, right? And they were kind of at the point where they were taking it from a lifestyle business to one where they saw the potential to scale, right? And so I think we saw some of the numbers on it. And of course, we did our financial work and we went, oh, there's real opportunity. We absolutely love the brand that they're playing in, the way that they connected with their customers. I think the locally sourced ingredients was an aspect of it as well. And kind of the talent, what you were saying with the team, but then a material innovation and material science perspective. And it was so nice that we went through how many conversations with them. They didn't even talk about being sustainable as part of their USP. They're just like, well, it is who we are. Our reason why people buy is this, our products are great and they work and they smell good. And they're like, well, yeah, we're also green in the background, but that's not their main reason for standing out. We went, okay, there's so many stories here and such a great way to sort of build a brand that we went, okay, you're not tying yourself just to one aspect of what the consumer's wanting, but you're integrated into your core. It's not just marketing. You're operating this way and in a way where we were like, oh, all across the board, just such a great opportunity.
Makes sense. Especially with so much about greenwashing in the press, you want someone who actually operates like that at their core and not just flinging it out there once they're already a large company. Makes a lot of sense. So if you were to give advice to founders right now who are trying to approach the both of you or both of your teams, what would you say for them to approach you with to show that, hey, this is something that you should really look at? Hey, yeah. How should they formulate a pitch to show the things that you actually care about right now? Any advice for founders who are going through that journey?
And I would give the advice to talk to any investor is know who you're talking to, like know who that investor is and understand if they're a corporate VC, what their priorities might be and some of the companies that they'd invested in before and kind of understand that from the overall VC standpoint and then who the partner or the principal or whomever you're talking to, trying to have a good understanding of that person and what they've done. And so I think it's really important to understand what are the businesses inside of a Comcast or an Estee Lauder and really understand who the pitch is. So that's, I think, really important. And then it's the normal pitch stuff, right? Like why is the team that you've assembled the right team to tackle the problem that you're trying to solve? So you want to get the investor excited about your team, about the market size and market potential of what you're building, and any tips you can give on traction, or I should say KPIs on traction or product or what you've built so far, obviously really important. And I think in this market, it's important to have an understanding not to go out and say, we're worth, don't throw a crazy valuation number on the table and say, wait for the VC to come back to you. And I'd be sort of cognizant of, we want to raise X amount of dollars and here's exactly how we're going to spend it. And it's going to take us 18 to 24 months or 12 to 18 months or wherever it is. But the understanding that in this market, it makes a lot of sense to be pretty careful on the runway and to understand what you're raising and how you're going to use that capital efficiently in the next couple of years.
I love that first piece of advice, because I'm guessing that is advice that you've experienced the opposite of very regularly, where someone's pitching you the exact same as someone else. When if they did a little bit of research or a little bit of Googling, or as I like to say, stalking, there could be some much better kind of ways for them to pitch you specifically. Nobody likes a templated pitch. Absolutely. And so it makes a lot of sense. The same thing we tell candidates, like in your personal world, stalking is bad. In the professional world, it's amazing. Go as deep as possible and they'll appreciate that, because that means preparation. So I really appreciate you touching upon that. How about from your end, Ryan? Any advice for founders who can wow you in some way?
Yeah, I'll layer on one idea. And I was an ex-founder myself. I find when, you know, you're building, it's so easy to be focused on what, you know, I was doing and what I was creating and to be looking internally. I think my advice is to look externally. And I'm kind of surprised at the amount of times that I'll meet a founder who hasn't surveyed their customers or spent time talking to their customers or who isn't aware of who their competitors are. Right. You can kind of look internally and say, well, I created this brand for my needs. And I created this business because this is what I need at the market. And very often I'll be like, well, 10 other of those existed. Right. And so I think when you're looking externally at kind of who the competitors are and who your customers are, and even at just like the market and that broader group, a lot of what we push is say like, what's your unique thesis? What's your reason to exist? And you can do a lot of that work internally, but you have to turn it externally to say, is this going to work within society for consumers and for where competitors are and for where the white space is? So I'd say you spend the time, it's weird to step away from what you're building, but spend time looking externally to kind of validate and test and understand and know where you can fit, develop that thesis.
I absolutely. And I would also say respond positively when someone is calling you out for those things, where some people get defensive. A couple of things that I hear when I'm calling out, look, there's five of you in the market already. What's the difference? I'll hear, no. Number one is no, but we're different. Or number two, like, no, but those people suck. Like what they're building totally sucks for this and this. I'm like, all right, when you get further along, you'll understand why they've done what they've done. There's usually a lot of reasons behind the scenes. So someone should really think about that. And I think there's a lot of folks who just don't take enough conversations where they're getting grilled aggressively and ingest those reasons that they're getting grilled. Like maybe you need some practice grilling before, you know, you're lucky enough to land a conversation between either of you. Where you get that practice grilling, it's not friends and family. They're not going to do it unless you've got a really good friend who you know is overly transparent. And one thing I'd like to see out in the market is more opportunities to pay people to grill you. I see it with a lot of our candidates as well who are for executive level roles. They've frankly just not been grilled by a founder team or a CEO the way that they're going to get in an interview process. And they walk in with their pitch. It's templated. It's the same pitch they give every single company they're interviewing with. And it's like, no, you've got to take these difficult questions. And I actually think these people need to pay for those, that grilling, because that's the only way you're going to get a real answer. So there's a platforms like Intro. It's really expensive though. You can pay like $500 to $1,000 to speak with like a founder or a VC or whatnot. But I'd like to see something out in the market that just you pay people to grill you and like really devil's advocate everything you're saying, because a lot of people don't get enough of that. Yeah.
We do that sometimes with our portfolio companies when they're going out to raise.
Oh, nice.
We'll assemble a group of us. I just did it recently and go through the deck with them and just ask them questions as if we were completely outside investors. So yeah.
Money plus.
There's a plus. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then on the flip side, any advice for other VCs who are out there and either in similar jobs as yours, but probably even just broadly, there's a lot of funds popping up over the last year or so that raised, let's say, from an LP of tens of millions of dollars. And they're trying to wade this market similarly as both of you are with the corporate VC backing. Any thoughts on how they could do their job better and any analogies or anything like that of the things that you've learned over the last year or so that you could pass on to some of these folks?
I mean, I would just say be there for your company and don't just sort of disappear. So it looks like things are getting chopped with the companies and it's easy to just say that's going to be a write-off or that, and I'll just focus on other companies and new investments. And I think it's really important to be there for your company that you've made investments in and be as supportive as you possibly can and help them get through the next year or two, next 10. But in my career, I've learned the most about who are good investors and there for their companies, typically when things aren't going as amazing as you want them to be.
Yeah.
But it's important to be there for the companies and help them the best you can. So
yeah, makes a lot of sense. Everyone was a genius 2 years ago. And we'll see how well they're doing now. How about yourself, Ryan?
And it is an interesting time because to your point, Anish, I think it was last year was the largest number of emerging VC funds were established ever. And I think the numbers show there's still a lot of undeployed capital out there. And so I think now it's still great for those VCs to differentiate themselves, right? The founders may be hungry for capital, but I still think finding your value add, your plus, your, what's your thesis, your unique space to be in, I think it's good, right? As great as advice as it is for a founder, like we take that into consideration ourselves, right? What can we add? I think the other thing, and for those not deploying cash, was a Warren Buffett that was like, you can think of it as stocks or you can think of it as socks and like remove the T out of it. And he's like, for some reason, we think of it as a consumer product, a 20% discount makes you more likely to buy. And I'm like, things are down. There's a reason, the reason why we continue to invest. It's not a point, I think, to be hesitant with your money. It's if you're waiting to determine where the market's going to go, you're going to miss an opportunity to get into some great deals at better valuation, right?
Yeah. Is what you're saying that like this is a great time because you are getting a better valuation, or what you're saying is waiting to time the market perfectly until it's at the very bottom and then going value hunting isn't necessarily or is necessarily like a good thing?
Yeah, I don't think you can time the market. And I'm always surprised when people think they can. So I think now is a great time. Like it's a value. It's value for VCs, right? As well as just an opportunity to support some great people. Like I think of rounds that we weren't able to get into because valuations were too high. And it's worth the chance now to join those founders on those journeys. And so I think getting out there and deploying and not waiting to time the market, it's a great space to be.
Absolutely. Okay. And both of your predictions for the exact date that it's going to be hitting the bottom. No, I'm joking. I really, really, really appreciate both your time here. I know I learned a ton. So thank you, Allison. And thank you, Ryan. You.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Can you give us a space?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.